The Word of Mouth podcast from NHPR is made possible with support from you, our subscribers.
And from Heinemann, a provider of resources written by real teachers for real classrooms. Heinemann values teachers as decision makers and students as curious learners. Discover the path to lifelong professional learning at Heinemann.com. Heinemann, dedicated to teachers.
This is Word of Mouth, your questions answered, your state explored. I'm Erica Janik. We have two stories for you today, both dealing with identity, or rather, who other people think we are. And we have a meditation on the weather from Sean Hurley. Up first is producer Jackie Helbert with a personal story about multiples, her own sisters, and some New Hampshire legislation.
No, your eyes aren't playing tricks on you. That's really three of the same sneaker, three of the same shorts, on three different brothers. Nicholas, Zachary, and Benjamin Osborne. They're getting their master's degrees at Georgetown University. The brothers know they may have to split up someday, but that day is not today.
Because if you start stressing about the future, then you won't even notice what's right in front of you. So we try to take each day at a time and just focus.
I am an identical triplet. Reuters estimates that only one in every 200 million births results in identical triplets.
Mom and Dad were first told they were having twins. Then a few weeks later, at a second ultrasound, doctors gave the couple an even bigger shock. Rare identical triplets.
Now I have three more mouths to feed, three more boys to feed. My first thought is, our car doesn't fit. I need a bigger car.
The first day of school is always filled with nerves, excitement, sometimes a little anxiety. Well, that is especially true for parents sending those kids off to class for the very first time. Those feelings tripled today for a couple in North Fulton County whose triplets headed off to kindergarten.
Hello.
Hey, can you hear me?
Yeah.
If you would go ahead and introduce yourself and tell me your name, age, like your job, anything you want people to know about you.
Do I have to say my age?
Yes, we're all
saying. I mean, they already know your age.
Just say it.
My name is Jenny Sneed. I'm 33, and I'm an art teacher. I live in Maryville, Tennessee.
Jenny got the brains.
My name is Harmony Witty. I live in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I'm an artist.
Harmony got the looks. I'm Jackie Helbert, a radio producer for New Hampshire Public Radio. And I'm told that I am the leftovers.
The single cell now starts to divide. First two, then four, then eight. And it's here that nature's most remarkable reproductive anomaly can sometimes occur.
I like to tell myself that I'm the original egg and the other two are just parasitic twins that happened to make it full term. People have a lot of weird ideas about multiples. We get the same questions over and over. Can you feel each other's pain? Do you share the same thoughts? Do you have the same dreams? Producer Jimmy Gutierrez asked us a few.
Are you all identical?
Yes. Yeah. Well, Harmony may be fraternal.
No, we are identical.
That is just so below the belt.
Were your mannerisms, obviously, when you were living together and growing up together, extremely similar?
Oh, yeah. I don't think about it, but when we're together, I definitely notice it. I'll move and she'll move in the same way.
And so, like, when we were younger, we would make an effort not to walk the same way because people, like, if you did, people were like, oh, they're walking the same or, oh, they're sitting the same. And so we'd try not to.
More than one person has asked if we have the same mother. Figure that one out yourself, Sherlock.
Twin sons, whom they named Romulus and Remus.
Multiples have been pop culture fodder ever since Romulus and Remus. That's hard to say.
They began to fight savagely.
You
so savagely,
got it, dude.
That the fight ended only when Remus lay dead. And so, Rome was given its name.
Come and play with us, Daddy.
Ed, you next!
He's not Fred, I am!
And let's not forget how writers get some kind of enjoyment out of killing one twin. You have another one left, so no harm, no foul.
I'm only joking. I am Fred.
How could you? It really doesn't matter if you can tell me, Jenny, and Harmony, or is it Harmony, Jenny, and I, apart. Because even though we agree on almost nothing now, we agree on this.
For another telepathy test, the twins are asked to arrange toy soldiers in the same order. It's just another game to them.
Hi, my name is Trisha Corcus. I am a teaching assistant in the Derry School District.
Have you ever had people ask if they share the same thoughts?
Yes. Yes, people ask that a lot. They talk about twin telepathy. My twins actually had that occur. One of my sons did not talk until he was almost three. When he did talk, he talked in complete sentences. But if we asked, what kind of ice cream would you want? One of the twins would say, well, I'll have vanilla. And he'd look at his brother and he goes, and he'd have chocolate. The twin who didn't talk always seemed to, like, it was what he did want.
If they punish John for being naughty, Jim also feels the smack and vice versa. But they not only feel alike, they think alike.
We're really shy.
Oh, yeah, we were all just painfully shy. We would do this thing that penguins do. They, like, jostle for a place on the iceberg and then push one of them into the ocean. And we would kind of do the same thing with each other, hiding behind mom's legs at the grocery store. When somebody stopped to talk to us, we would all jostle to see which two could stand behind mom and who would have to be the face of the triplets.
A little side note here. Penguins push each other into the ocean because if one of them gets eaten, the others know it's not safe. Penguins are...
Let's continue that shyness. And if we're together, even still, even this weekend... you tried to shove me into talking to some people.
Yeah, ahead of you.
Young multiples often rely on their siblings to communicate. We sure did.
Twin language.
Everyone loved it. When we were toddlers, we were the perfect party trick, a sideshow. It was loads of fun until we went to school.
The first day of school is always filled with nerves, excitement, sometimes a little anxiety. Those feelings tripled today for a couple in North Fulton
Five
County whose
sets of
triplets
twins.
Headed off to kindergarten.
All sharing a unique sibling bond.
No. Sometimes she's mean to me.
And sometimes she's mean to me.
No, I'm not. Honey, send it.
I still struggle a month into school. There's one set that I definitely still struggle with trying to tell between the two.
I do believe that twins should be in separate classrooms at school.
Some, quote, experts, no doubt singletons, think multiples should be split up. Like this lady who shall not be named that I found on YouTube.
It really does help to be separated because you can minimize the comparison and the competition. And most importantly, children will be known so much better by their peers and by the teachers because they'll be seen as individuals and not as a unit.
Back to me. I mean, us.
Yesterday you said that being separated in school is the worst of your life. Can you re-say that and then talk about why? Yeah, the day they separated us in second grade after we'd been together in school thus far was the most traumatic day of my life.
Not to sound overly dramatic here, but being forced to go to separate classrooms felt like a dissection, a ripping that left us fragmented into three cute horcruxes. Many experts who have done legitimate scientific studies see it differently. The University of Toledo described the problems. Focusing was perceived by the twins as being difficult due to the urge they possessed of having to know where their co-twin was and what they were doing.
Like all of my comfort had been ripped away from me. Like I was standing in front of the world alone and naked, basically. To walk into the school and have to split up, I can't describe it. It was like being torn into separate pieces and to go into different classrooms and to be alone and have to like just be myself. I didn't know how to be myself.
We literally had never ever been apart, like...
Like, not even for a minute. Mm-hmm. We were together 24 hours a day.
All right, it's true multiples need to learn to be their own person, to have their own identity, yada yada. No one wants to be one of those sad sacks who never spend a day apart and they wear the same outfits, eat the same food, braid each other's hair well into their 80s. No thank you, codependent creepies. This is where Trisha Korskov and her twin boys come back into the picture. Her sons were getting ready to enter school in Hooksett when she joined the Queen City Mothers of Twins. She heard horror stories from parents whose twins had been separated in school.
That kids would cry and scream, and that there were behavioral problems at home.
It was so bad that some of the parents pulled their kids out of public school and put them into private school. In 2005, the Queen City Mothers began working towards getting legislation passed to stop the forced separations. It was known as the Twin Bill.
And ask the bill's prime sponsor to come forward.
Trisha's boys were getting prepared to start school. She's quoted as telling the Seacoast Online,
"The idea of separating twins came from a pre-World War II feeling that twins needed to form their own identities. That's not the view many parents have today."
The parents' point of view is that if twins are separated before they're ready, or multiples before they're ready, that it can have adverse effects on them for years to come, because if they're not developmentally ready to be apart, they're always worried about their twin. And then they don't have time to focus on being educated.
A study from the University of South Africa, legitimate, found grades decrease. They suffer from anxiety, depression, and social withdrawal more than non-separated twins. Trying to get a bill passed is no walk in the park. But there were three twin clubs in New Hampshire, and the mothers quickly rallied together parents of multiples. They compiled a huge email distribution list of supporters.
You've got mail.
When the mothers went to the Capitol, they took their multiples with them in a show of force. The first time they showed up, it was a madhouse with hordes of matching little ones.
The House people more communicated with their representatives, but on the Senate side, people emailed and called state senators all over the state.
Okay. Brian, we're not taking the
supports from the After negotiating details, fixing grammar problems, and jumping through numerous political hoops, the Twin Bill finally passed.
It says, in the year of our Lord, 2007, one new section of pupils or other multiple classroom placement of twins and other multiple be enacted by the Senate and House of Representatives in general court convened. And when it was passed in the House, the whole upper chamber of the House was mothers with multiples.
Trisha's boys decided themselves they wanted to split up in the fifth grade. She said they're really happy with their choice. My sisters and I were removed from public school and homeschooled in the fourth grade. It was nice to be back together. New Hampshire is one of a dozen or so states with twin laws on the books. Thanks to the twin law, other multiples won't have to go through automatic separations in school.
That was producer Jackie Helbert on her own experience as a triplet and the twin law in New Hampshire. When you go outside these days, it seems like you're always getting wet. That seems to be the new way of life here in New Hampshire. With the ongoing deluge apparently unwilling to end, our own Sean Hurley decided to write a little letter to the rain.
Dear rain, hello, it's me. How are you? Well, I gather. I wanted to apologize for my remarks the other day, which were insensitive and loud and not very favorable as far as you, but I was upset and wet, thoroughly, to the bone, both, which doesn't excuse anything. I certainly wouldn't like it if someone came into my office and yelled at me for doing my work so well, but that is what I did. You are the rain, and you are simply falling, excellently. As you well know, I am not an umbrella man. No yellow rain slicker or big rubber boots for me. This isn't a fashion choice. I just always believe I can get away with it. You have proven me wrong. I do like the look of a black umbrella, I should say. Dozens of them, floating down the street like serious balloons. And I like how yellow rain slickers turn everyone into children. But I guess I'm wondering if everything is okay up there. Maybe, I don't know, you've decided not to come another day, per the injunction. Just opted to move in with us, pell-mell and into perpetuity, with the infinite luggage of your neat, little, teardrop satchels. Let me just say here, I don't blame you. Possibly the clowns are up to something in their supervisory way. Or it could even be the old golden one, melting up rivers and lakes in parts unknown, and thinking it wise to redistribute said rivers and lakes to our region. Well, I should remind you, we have such features, and they are fine. There are those among us who no longer believe in the color blue. Others who've forgotten that thing we used to call the sun. And so I'd ask you, kindly and formally this time via this letter, and in my quasi-legal capacity as a very damp person, to cease and desist by means of the customary sing-songy terms of our long-standing agreement.
Rain, rain, go away, come again another day. Rain, rain, go away, come again another day.
Sincerely yours, John Hurley, Esquire, for the offices of Waterlogged, Damp, and Sodden. P.S. Snow.
That was NHPR reporter Sean Hurley. Do you have a question about New Hampshire? We're always looking for stories. Whether you're a lifelong Granite Stater or you're a transplant just settling in, chances are you've probably encountered something like this. You're driving along some stretch of I-93 or walking on a trail in the White Mountains, and suddenly you notice something that made you wonder, what's up with that? No matter what you're wondering, we want to know. What questions do you have about New Hampshire? Send us your questions and we might be able to track down an answer. They can be large or small, silly or serious, all questions are welcome. And chances are, yours could end up sparking a pretty interesting follow-up investigation. Sometimes the very best stories are hiding in plain sight. So leave us a message at 603-513-7796 or send us an email at wordofmouth@nhpr.org. We can't wait to hear from you. Our next story comes from Outside In. I'll let Sam Evans-Brown take it from here.
Hey, Kathy.
Sam, big fan. Big fan.
Can I just say, I remember like the very early days of our podcast, you tweeted something about the show, and I was just like, somebody from New York City who used to work for Radiolab has listened to our show.
Oh my God, I binged like all the episodes as soon as I found it.
So you were an Outside In listener from the early days, which I appreciate.
Yes, it's so good.
Can you just introduce yourself real quick?
Yeah, my name is Kathy Tu, and I co-host a podcast from WNYC Studios called Nancy, All Things Queer.
All Things Queer.
Yeah.
So, Kathy Tu, I called you up because I wanted to talk to you about your purchasing habits.
Ugh.
Would you say that you buy anything that you would classify as gear?
Yeah. I mean, my backpack would be gear, right? That's gear.
Yeah. Well, tell me more about backpacks.
Backpacks have been around since the dawn of time when people needed to carry things from one place to another.
So what do you look for when you're buying a backpack?
For me, when you find the right backpack for the right situation, it's like the heavens parted and it is just the right feeling. It's the right fit. It's just, I don't know, it's like having a child. It's like having, you have a child.
I do.
Don't you feel like
it's the right one for you.
Oh, that is absolutely true.
Yeah, now imagine that with me and backpacks. It's like a thing that it just fits like another part of my body.
Are there like backpacks that you go to the store and you're like, oh, this is one that clearly has been assigned a gender?
Oh, definitely. And for guys, it's usually some color palette along the lines of black and gray. It's always like sleek. Hmm. It's always got to look very, it could fit both like an urban environment, but you can also like take it out camping with you or something. It's got to look versatile. That's what guys love, apparently. And then when you go to like the women's section, and usually you have colors in all variety. You have like a lot of pink and purple, light grays, not dark grays, because that's guys, light grays.
Right.
And they tend to be smaller, lighter, and or have superfluous things.
Yeah, so like fringe or like...
Yes, yeah. Fringe. And like maybe it's just the way that I've been conditioned to think about these things, where I just assume now at this point, because of all the backpacks I've seen, that backpacks that are marketed towards men are just more functional. I tend to see things in multicolors and think that they're just pretty. They're meant to just be pretty and not so much functional. So I feel like I just like glance over them and I head straight to the guys section, because in my mind I'm like, this will be a backpack that I will find useful and not just pretty.
Oh, that's so interesting. So it's like the colors are like a cue that you know it's going to be garbage.
Kind of. Oh my God, am I just like biased though against colors? I don't know.
So I have heard complaints about quote unquote women's gear since forever, for as long as I've been hanging out with women in the outdoors.
Mm-hmm.
But as a very conventionally shaped fit dude,
mm-hmm.
I'm like not at all the right person to investigate this question because everything's made for me. It's like, oh, well, here's another piece of apparel that fits perfectly.
Yeah.
So this is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. And today we're digging into the fraught relationship between the gear industry and gender. And to do this, we've talked to three women who are on the front lines of this question, because frankly, I am not the right person for the job.
Oh, bless you, Sam. Bless you.
Let me rewind. So I spent about 2.5 years looking for the perfect bike.
To start us off on this tour, I'd like you to meet Hannah Weinberger. She's a freelancer and a Twitter friend, and she reviews a lot of gear.
I have been on staff at Outside Magazine, Bicycling Magazine, and Wirecutter.
Okay, back to her search for the right bike.
And a few companies segmented out women's versions, so I felt kind of compelled to understand better the design philosophies behind these products if they were things that I was going to be reviewing.
So here's the central tension that she lays out when it comes to the gear industry and women. When do women actually need something different? And when are companies just looking to make more money by selling women a product that is essentially the same?
Okay, so. So Body Glide, right?
Okay, yeah.
Everybody uses Body Glide.
Body Glide, if you somehow don't know, is a product that looks like a stick of deodorant that you rub onto your skin to prevent chafing during sports.
Body Glide has really extended their product line in recent years to have Body Glide that's basically Body Glide, but they've got like Body Glide skin, Body Glide foot, because each of your skin patches need something
some sort
very
of different formulation.
I'm not a dermatologist, so I'm out here just making egregious claims. But anyway, they have Body Glide Her.
Yeah.
And when I looked into the ingredients lists, it's really just that, you know, there are more emollients and it smells slightly better. And lo and behold, the stick is pink. And I don't, you know.
Like she said, she's not a dermatologist, but the point is that even though there are some items that probably would work fine for either gender, companies will produce a new product if they can convince you to buy it. Hannah has made a nifty little flowchart showing when she thinks women should shop in the women's section. Basically, the question comes down to, how much is the item actually touching your body? A base layer designed to wick sweat away from you? It'd be nice if that was tailored to fit you. A bike, on the other hand, you really only touch with your hands, your butt, and your feet. So maybe only those specific parts need to be tweaked for your body.
It seems like the first major piece of outdoor gear for women is the jock bra or the jog bra. In the mid-1970s, two companies created sports bras for women. So there's Moving Comfort and this group that created the jock bra, which I'm still trying to parse whether it's just an urban legend, but it's based on what a jock strap would look like if it were for your top half as a woman.
The story of the sports bra is, as far as I can tell, a pretty triumphant one. A female-owned company makes a female-designed product that was quickly adopted by grateful women everywhere. But as Title IX helped to usher more women into sports through the 70s, gear companies started to see dollar signs. In the 80s, K2 put out a ski called the Ladies Top Performance Ski, which
did not offer the same performance benefits as the men's models and was really targeted at beginner skiers. When you're trying to really shred a turn and you need that, you know, that spring and snap and, you know, the camber needs to support you, you're not going to get it with that ski.
And so begins the era of Shrink It and Pink It.
The whole idea of Shrink It and Pink It is that women's products are an abstraction of men's products. So women are an afterthought in the design process. And what happens is that you will take your men's product and make it smaller and make it a female appealing color.
So we're in this period, so 80s and 90s, where everything's getting shrunk and punked.
Shrinked and pinked.
Shrinked and pinked. Did you get a sense from folks who you talked to who were athletes in this period or female people in the outdoor industry in this period that they saw this as better than the sort of like unisex, boxy, flappy, not really fitting anyone times?
For the most part, it was an improvement, if not a parallel move. For women's specific clothing, it can be really helpful because you're going to find pants that are slightly more tailored to your body, shirts that don't chafe as much because there's not as much loose material. But when you talk to people who are really at the top of their sport, Pink It and Shrink It is an offense. Like, one of my favorite mountain bikers, Amanda Batty, she ended up sewing her own jerseys because she couldn't stand the jerseys available to her, and that it's only been within the past few years that she has deigned to wear a women's short just because they were subpar.
This is where Kathy's backpack angst comes from. Gear in so-called women's colors is often just lousy. Metal gear loops become fabric gear loops. Pockets disappear. Zippers are cheaper. You do have to give the gear industry some credit. REI, in particular, launched an initiative last year called Force of Nature, which includes dozens of profiles of all types of female athletes, $20 million pledged to support groups that are already working to get more women outside, and a, quote, stepped-up effort, unquote, to develop more gear for women that is just as good as men's gear and actually suited for female bodies. But even today, it seems pretty clear that Shrink It and Pink It is still a thing. And even just getting a woman's version of a product on the shelves is something of a slog.
Companies look for women to purchase unisex products before they're comfortable making a women-specific line. So at Camelback, they are redesigning their unisex trail running vests to have a wider size run because women have been buying those unisex trail running vests, even if they aren't designed for women's bodies, it's, you know, the best option available to them.
Right. So it's like this weird chicken and egg thing where
exactly
a certain number of women need to like sacrifice their bodies using something that's not optimal before the rest can have the benefit of something that's actually designed for them.
Modern human sacrifice. Perfect.
God damn it, Sam. I have been a human sacrifice.
Do you feel like you've been a human sacrifice?
Yeah, now I do.
Yeah, and that's just gear for women who fit the industry's image of the, like, quote-unquote outdoorsy woman. But what if you don't fit that image?
Man, this is full-on overstimulating.
There's such a smell to outdoor gear. It's like...
smells like ski
wax. No, I was going to say it smells like the Nordic lodges grind.
With this history in mind, we sent our contributor, Cordelia Zars, on a field trip to a gear show.
This is like a very man-centric meat station.
Yeah. Number one sports nutrition meat snacks. Can you say that a little bit deeper in your voice?
Meat snacks. That's as low as I can go.
She's tagging along with Elise Rylander.
Yes, so my name is Elise Rylander. I use she, her pronouns, and I work with Out There Adventures, which is based in the Seattle area.
This was the Winter Outdoor Retail Show in Denver, the largest gear expo in the world, which means...
The advertisements, though, I mean, still look at that woman. I don't know, it's kind of a...
Oh, yeah, they're selling sex, for sure. Yeah. It's a lot of the women that we've seen thus far have been in your, like, high fashion, pouty lip...
Mouths open.
Yeah.
And Elise was looking for something specific.
My queerdar just went off a little bit. But you never know, you know?
She was looking for representations of people who might be queer in the advertising. And she was disappointed. Well, with one notable exception.
One queer ad with Ellen DeGeneres for the... maybe her own sock line? She's rocking some socks.
Yeah. Doesn't look super outdoorsy, though.
Nope, she's sitting in a living room. Next to a woman who's sitting outside...
barely outside.
Underneath an awning.
Elise's organization, Out There Adventures, takes queer kids on trips in the outdoors. She grew up in Wisconsin, and like a lot of us, being outdoors was where she felt like she could be herself.
I was totally a tomboy growing up, and now as an adult, I have short hair. I express my gender on the more masculine side. When I go back to the Midwest, I get sirred all the time. And I was able to wear whatever I wanted, to do whatever I wanted, to be as much of a tomboy as I wanted to be when I was in those outdoor spaces. And I had a difficult time assimilating into more urban cultures because there's a totally different set of expectations in those spaces. And then as an adult, I have found that to be true as well. You know, when I was living in Alaska, when I moved up there, my mom was a bit fearful. She said something like, don't go waving your rainbow flag up there. And I found that space was the most welcoming of all the places that I have lived, even more so than Seattle, because folks up there just possess a different mentality, and they're just so concerned with other things. They don't really have the time to be like, oh, why is your hair short? Or why are you wearing men's pants? They're just like, hey, my car broke down. I need some help. Can you give me a lift to town? You know?
Kathy Tu and I interviewed Elise together.
Okay, so maybe just to get into it a little bit, I personally love being outdoors, and I think for me the hardest thing is trying to find clothes that fit me, especially if I want to do anything that requires sort of like lots of pieces of clothing. Like snowboarding requires jacket and pants and gloves and other things, and when I go looking for them, all I see are clothes with colors that to me seem really infantilizing, and I have a hard time finding things that fit, that don't look that way, because I'm basically a tomboy, and to me it's just never felt right.
Yeah, well, I'm lucky in that the way that my body just simply is, I can often fit in like typical men's smalls. I wear like a size 32 pants pretty easily. And it's nice because those are often the sizes that go on sale, like at Patagonia and whatnot. you know, but that's not true for a lot of folks. And I've written a couple of articles and given a couple talks on why everything in the women's line has to be, usually it's just all about yoga pants or clothes to wear to a yoga class. And then everything is a shade of purple or teal or black, you know, and those are your three options. You know, and so it's hard to get these huge companies who have been doing things this way for their entire histories to start to think about these things a little bit differently. But we are seeing that conversation begin to shift. And it's also important to recognize the context in which we're having this conversation, because I know that in certain markets in Asian countries, they have unisex clothes, and it is easier for them to come up with things that fit a whole different host of body types that are all sorts of different sizes. I think that that's harder to accomplish in the States because, or in Western cultures, because the body shapes and sizes can vary a little bit more potentially. But these things are already happening in other parts of the world. We just haven't been super successful in bringing them into this particular context as of yet.
I was thinking about this. If you were to talk to the outdoor industry, the ways that they might try to explain this away is they're saying, listen, we're just trying to serve the market that we've got, who tend to be a certain shape, and that's what we're building. And so, like, hey, it's not about gender. It's just about, like, the people who buy our stuff. And if we were to make stuff for bigger people, or if we were to make things that were built for women that didn't have these feminine tones, it wouldn't get bought. Have you ever heard that as, like, an explanation, and do you buy it?
You know, it's funny. I haven't ever explicitly heard that sentiment. I think that is what they think. But I think women who, and I'm making a lot of stereotypes here, but I think, you know, generally women who are of, like, the Generation X or Millennial generation, and especially Generation Z, would be totally fine buying a coat in pretty much any color. And I don't think that they would, I would venture to guess that the majority of women going into a store wouldn't be put off by the fact that a jacket wasn't available in purple or teal. And ultimately, you know, they are concerned about their bottom line. And I think that perhaps there is that fear that it will affect it. But I think even more so than them thinking that they're going to lose sales, I think they just don't really know. They don't have enough beta, and so they're not willing to make that sort of leap. I have told a number, we've got really great relationships with a couple of major retailers in the industry, and I've had separate conversations with a number of them where I've said, you know, y'all are in a race. You might not realize it, but you are, in fact, competing with each other. And the first company to figure out how to make more culturally relevant clothing well is going to win. Secretly, I'm motivated by trying to, like, prod them along a little bit quicker, try to pit them against each other.
Apart from taking kids on wilderness trips and aggressively prodding the gear industry, Elise helped organize the first ever LGBTQ outdoor summit.
You know, so we had representation from huge names like the Wilderness Society, Nature Conservancy, Sierra Club, Patagonia was there, North Face, REI hosted the first day and had a bunch of staff there. I think that the interesting thing is the representatives that were sent from those different organizations and companies were there because they were queer. And so I don't know that the information that was presented at the summit was, you know, necessarily novel to those different folks, because that is, you know, largely speaking to their lived experience.
Because this is one of those things that I sort of wonder about a lot, and that's the degree to which the industry is willing to, you know, like, this is kind of a mean way to say it, and you know, if it's not true, I apologize to anybody I offend, but, like, oh, we're just going to send along the, like, token queer person who works in our company, and they're going to represent at this thing, but, like, we're not actually going to do much to address the concerns that are being presented there. And is that something that ever worries you, that the outdoor industry is just sort of, like, playing you along?
Oh, all the time. Yeah. So partly the reason why I think that these different folks came to this first one is because it was the first one, right? And so I think it makes sense. I didn't take it personally that we didn't have Yvonne Chouinard there this year. Next year, though, might be a little bit of a different story. And so I do get a little bit concerned about how the industry might monetize certain identities or certain types of queer people and prioritize them over other identity types. I think culturally we aren't ready for, you know, the trans woman of color to also be a badass climber, right? That's a confluence of identities that is really confusing to mainstream society. And so those are the exact identities that need serious representation, but they are also not the ones that are going to get paid by REI, you know, to promote their Instagram account. And so I'm fearful that the industry, like it has done with other marginalized groups, will pick a couple of queer folks, and they're probably going to be white, and they're probably going to be cis, and they might be blonde, and they're going to uphold them as sort of like the voice of the overall community. I think that it probably will end up being that way.
Well, it's sort of like, it's funny because, like, if that were to come to pass, that's a person who would likely already fit quite neatly into the products they already sell.
Exactly.
So, who doesn't fit very neatly into the products already being sold? Women whose bodies don't match what the outdoor industry puts into its marketing material.
I know that going to the women's section, nothing's gonna fit me, right? So I usually have to shop in the men's section, and that just means that especially like my outerwear, like I have like a mountain gear rain jacket that I got at the Columbia Outlet store here in Portland. And, you know, it works. It's like, it's long enough and it fits me, but it's like definitely too big in the arms and shoulders, you know, it's ill fitting, I would say. So I just like, I don't know. I'm just at this point now where I don't care. Like, I just want to get outside. So if I have an ill fitting rain jacket, it doesn't matter to me, you know?
This is Summer Michaud Skog.
I'm Summer. I founded the organization called Fat Girls Hiking. We're a community-based organization that focuses on marginalized people getting into the outdoors and how we can give them access to the outdoors in ways that maybe other outdoor communities can't or don't.
Do you think it's easier for plus-size men versus plus-size women to find gear that fits them?
Yeah, and totally. Even just men's clothes in general is already bigger. Sometimes I can fit into like a men's large but it would be a men's large is the same as like a women's 2X or something, you know, so the sizing is totally different, but you know, it would be nice. I like the color purple. Well, they don't make men's rain jackets in purple. So that's a really big bummer for me.
Well, and it is funny too that there are all these plus size clothes for men in the men's section, and it's almost just like guys have more permission to be fat than women do in our society.
Absolutely, because in our culture, women are raised to believe that their worth is based their worth and their value is based on the way that they look, and men don't have those same standards. That men's worth and value is based on other things, and it has nothing to do with their size or their appearance at all. It's ridiculous. I mean, not to say that like men don't experience fat phobia, or that, you know, fat oppression exists, I think, for any for any gender, but there definitely is more permission, I think, for fat men to exist and be in their bodies in a way that women don't have that same permission.
And if Elise Rylander, who we talked to earlier, the founder of Out There Adventures and the LGBTQ Outdoor Summit, thinks that people like Summer are the folks who the gear industry should be supporting, Summer looks to the community she's created for that support.
I don't get grants. I have started taking donations for hikes that I lead, but yeah, I personally don't really want to be sponsored by a corporation. And I feel like if I'm taking money from corporations that their mission doesn't really align with the Fat Girls Hiking mission, then I feel like I'm selling out.
Again, there are signs that one can point to that the industry is starting to get its act together when it comes to plus-size clothing. And once again, the example we can point to comes from REI, which has a snappily named campaign for a new initiative to create more size runs in its clothing. Less labels, more sizes. Call Summer jaded, but she's not ready to declare mission accomplished.
at this point, I'm so bitter. Like, I don't even care. I'm just like, I don't want to like congratulate REI for their less labels, more sizes tour that they did. I just feel like now they're finally realizing they can make money off of off of fat people, and that's their only motive. But I mean, I could be totally off base here. This is just my opinion, and I definitely go there sometimes because, you know, and I'm a member, so I'm a walking contradiction. But it's hard. It's hard when you can't find stuff in your size.
It does seem like this is an example of a market waiting to be tapped. A 2016 study found that the average woman in America is actually between a size 16 and 18. Though, let's just acknowledge here that women's clothing sizes are all over the map and incredibly arbitrary. And as Summer points out, there is a thriving industry of small companies that are creating plus-size activewear. So, once upon a time, I read that Patagonia justified not making additional size runs of a bunch of their gear because they said doing so would create waste. That basically, that, you know, people wouldn't buy the clothes and therefore it would just all go to waste, and that there isn't a market for plus size gear. Just judging from like some of your previous comments, I take it you don't buy that.
No, it's not. I mean, the thing that's funny, if you are an actual fat person who is like looking for plus size gear online, and they're sold out, and it's like, I know that I have a huge following on social media, and I know that when I am talking about gear to my community, they are really strongly saying that they want these things. And so to imply that it would be wasteful is really, to me, also implying that that they don't value fat people in the outdoors, that they don't value or even believe that fat people are going outdoors. I mean, I personally don't want your Patagonia, but other people do. So you make it for them, make it for the community, and it will get sold, you know?
Kathy, too.
Yes.
Thank you for coming on this journey with me.
Always.
To me, I think that the question here that a lot of people who are maybe skeptical of the ideas that we've gone through here want answered is this demand that exists and is just not being served? You know, plus-size women, women who don't want pink and purple stuff. Or would the gear industry really have to take a hit in order to produce the products that these women want and say they need?
So, Sam, let's just pivot just a little bit to, say, the film industry and how films are coming out now. Black Panther, Crazy Rich Asians. Like, the markets are actually there. It's whether or not the people who are at the very top, who have all the resources to actually even take a hit.
Take that risk.
To take that risk, yeah. Because if they don't, who else is supposed to do that?
Well, and anybody who says, oh, you know, if this was a market, then the market would have provided gear that these women are looking for, and that just ignores like who has access to capital.
Oh, totally. Yeah, the idea of a free market is really biased towards people with privilege. So, like, what are we supposed to do, Sam, until that happens, until somebody takes a risk? What are we supposed to do?
Wear ill-fitting clothing that is in colors that make you feel alienated, of course.
How does that make you feel? You had to do that.
Well, you know, because I've never had to, I have basically no place to start.
Interesting. All right, Sam, you meet me in what's between New Hampshire and New York?
Connecticut.
We'll go to Connecticut. We'll go to a shop. I will dress you up in the women's section. And then you tell us how you feel.
This is how we should have ended this episode. This is what we should have done. What are we doing with ourselves here?
Today's show was produced by me, Erica Janik, with Jackie Helbert, Sam Evans-Brown, Kathy Tu, Taylor Quimby, Jimmy Gutierrez, Hannah McCarthy, and Justine Paradise. Music in this episode from Poddington Bear, Blue Dot Sessions, and Breakmaster Cylinder. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.